Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Last week, the bulk of the National Park Service Advisory Board resigned en masse in condemnation of Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke's abject indifference to climate change and the department's massive rollback of protections for public lands. This comes on top of the Trump administration's announcement that it will open up offshore oil drilling along the coasts of almost every coastal state. This morning, we talk with Adam Fetterman, a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, whose prescient investigative series into the Department of Interior under the Trump administration has been featured in the Nation magazine over the past several months. Adam, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me.
Well, there's been a lot of news about the Department of the Interior in the last few weeks, and I guess let's start with the two big stories of the last 2 weeks, one being the plans to drill off the coasts of every coastal state in the United States, and the other one being this mass resignation of the advisory board. So maybe starting with the mass resignation, we can kind of work backwards to why all these scientists have resigned from this advisory board for the Department of the Interior.
Yeah, you know, I think both of these recent developments are indicative of the way Zinke has conducted business at the Department of the Interior from the very beginning, which is to shut out advisors and climate scientists and to pursue sort of unapologetic oil and gas, unapologetic agenda in favor of the oil and gas industry. So the resignation of the National Park System Advisory Board, I mean, essentially what they said is that they had been completely shut out of consulting and engaging with the department, which of course is their is what they do. So they had been waiting after repeated attempts to meet with the secretary and to work with him. You know, I think they all came in with relatively open minds, and they were rebuffed. So realizing that you know they were not going to be able to do what their advisory panel is supposed to do, they resigned.
So what is this an indication of? I mean, first of all, what were the specific issues why they resigned, and what does this show about the way that the Department of Interior is functioning?
Well, I think, you know, it's somewhat unclear precisely which issues they resigned over, because they never had the opportunity to engage with Zinke and his political appointees. But we do know that the department has essentially move to eliminate climate change from its strategic plan, which had been fundamental to sort of the Obama era approach to managing public lands. And in fact, the department has to confront climate change in much of what it does. So I think that was certainly high on the list of why the advisory board resigned. And you know, the other important thing to point out is now Zinke will have the opportunity to replace all of these individuals. So I think what we're seeing in general is an attempt to push out those who are not sympathetic with the administration's agenda and to replace them with, you know, like-minded folks.
Well, we've seen sort of the same concern with the Department of State and other agencies and divisions in the government. What happens? I mean, people at least a year ago were being encouraged to hold on to your jobs, hang in there, the people who are not the political appointees but the career appointees. What does it mean that they can't even hold on anymore?
Yeah, well, I think one important distinction to make is that the advisory board, they were not employees of the department. I mean, this is an independent outside body that it does serve an important function, but they were not employees of the department. So career civil servants are, by and large, I think, trying to continue to do the work that they've done. There have been some resignations. I mean, the most high profile is Joel Clement, a top climate scientist and policy advisor, who was one of more than 30 senior executive employees who were reassigned in mid-June without any notice. He was moved to an office that collects royalties from the oil and gas industry. So he filed a whistleblower complaint and has since resigned. A handful of others have also resigned, and I think that many career folks are struggling to hang on and try to, you know, do what they have been doing for decades in many cases.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the key firings or reassignments that have happened in the Department of the Interior. And Joel Clement in particular, there's something that seemed to be kind of evil about that reassignment. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Right. Well, I mean, Joel put it pretty well himself when he said in an op-ed in the Washington Post that, you know, it was pretty clear that his skills and expertise were not being fully realized in the accounting office collecting royalties. You know, he has absolutely no background in that, so it didn't make any sense to move him there. Now Joel had spent 6 or 7 years working on the impact of climate change on coastal communities in Alaska, and he'd been quite outspoken about the very real and urgent threat that many of these native communities face up there. And he feels and has spelled this out in his complaint that his reassignment was politically motivated.
But beyond that, the idea that he was going to be reassigned to collect royalties for these oil and gas projects that he actually didn't want to have approved. I mean, that's what really got me, is that's where the mendacity really seemed to come in. It's not just assigning him to a position that he has no expertise in or probably no interest, but it's like making him do something he probably is really opposed to doing.
Right. There does seem to be a bit of intentional, an attempt to kind of, I guess, rub it in. But you know, what we're seeing in general is these kinds of issues just being pushed aside. And you know, I think Clement would have been willing to continue to do what he could have done within the limitations imposed by an administration that essentially ignores climate change. So the fact that he was driven to file this complaint and eventually resign is a big deal. I mean, these career civil servants don't take this stuff lightly. I mean, they really have to be pushed far to publicly resign.
So what's happening with his complaint now?
Well, there's a special counsel that investigates the complaint, and as far as I know, it's a couple of months away from issuing any kind of findings. I think the bar is pretty high for establishing, you know, wrongdoing in these cases. So I don't know how things will play out in Joel's case in particular.
So you're sounding a little bit skeptical that he's going to get any justice.
Well, the fact is that the department has pretty wide latitude in terms of what it can do with these senior executive service employees, as they're known. I mean, they are under statute, they can be reassigned. The way that these reassignments were conducted, from what I've heard, you know, they were highly unprofessional and did not conform to the way that these things are normally done, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be slapped with any kind of violation. So, yeah, it's hard to say.
Well, another high-profile dismissal, let's say, was that of Dr. Virginia Burkett, who is a very notable and important climate scientist known worldwide. Let's talk a little bit about her reassignment and sort of the aftermath of that.
Yeah, you know, Virginia's case was also quite interesting. I mean, each case needs to be examined on its own, and I'll explain why. I mean, Virginia was reassigned to serve in an advisory role in the Office of Water and Science, which is a very political position. And she, as you mentioned, has done pioneering work on climate change and especially impacts on coastal communities. And I think she ended up taking a pay cut, leaving the senior executive service, and returning to a lower grade position at the U.S. Geological Survey, which she feels will allow her to be able to continue to do the research that she has been doing. So, she has not left the department. She's still there, but she is in a very different role. And I think that she felt that to accept that reassignment would have meant essentially giving up her ability to even speak out on some of these issues.
So how much ability does she have to speak out in the position that she has now?
Well, I think everyone's pretty cautious. You know, the idea that people are going to bang the drum about climate change now is foolish, because they know that to do so means crossing that line. And I've talked to a number of scientists who've told me that in applications for grant proposals and that kind of thing, they're removing the words climate change from project titles and proposals, even though the fundamentals of the research remain the same. So I think many of them are making this calculation that, you know, look, we want to try to continue to do this work, but we have to figure out how to do it within this new political regime.
Well, the chillingness of this reminds me of the ways in some of the petro states in this country as well as around the world, it's been verboten to talk about climate change. And I was in a conversation with a bunch of journalists a few years ago in New Orleans, and people who were working for the public radio station in New Orleans were talking about how they could not use the term climate change in any of the stories that they reported. And for those of us who didn't live on the Gulf Coast and didn't live in oil producing states, it was really shocking. But it seems like this kind of chilling silencing is now, I mean, that what was kind of, I guess, accepted practice in New Orleans and Texas and places like that has now become national policy.
Yes, I think we're seeing that across federal agencies, certainly not just at the Department of the Interior. But, you know, USGS plays a pretty important role in the study of climate science and climate change. They have several climate science centers, 8 of them throughout the country, and they work on really working with local and state agencies to figure out how to deal with the impacts of climate change that are being felt now. And those climate centers in the initial budget, Trump budget, called for reducing them from 8 to 4 and cutting their funding substantially, as well as sort of modifying their mission. So some of that funding has been restored in the latest iteration of the budget, but I think folks who work at those centers are really walking on eggshells and just trying to, you know, to determine if their climate science centers and their positions are even going to be around in another year.
Well, in one of the articles that you wrote about Virginia Burkett, you mentioned that she was driving to her new job from Washington, D.C. to New Orleans, or to Louisiana, I don't remember exactly where. And so it seems like she's kind of going to get a double whammy now, being in Louisiana, where you can't use the word climate change.
Yeah, I mean, Virginia has spent a lot of time in Louisiana, and that's what she calls home. You know, so hopefully she and people like her will be able to continue to operate and do their work. But I think there are just a lot of questions still about how funding is going to be apportioned and whether they're going to crack down even more on climate science-related research.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Adam Fetterman, who's a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. And we're talking about the gutting of climate change and the study of climate science from the Department of Interior, and a lot of chilling effects that are happening in the way that this department is being reorganized under the Trump administration. Well, you talked about these two scientists who have been focusing a lot on coastal impacts of climate change. Let's talk about this other coastal impact, potential coastal impact of the Department of Interior on these plans that released a few weeks ago to drill off of just about every state that has a coastline in the United States.
Yeah, the offshore drilling plan, I mean, it's gotten a lot of, there's been a lot of pushback. Interestingly, even from Republican governors and Republican delegations, to open up, as you say, just about every inch of coastal water to possible oil and gas development. You know, this is in line with the department's approach to energy production. You know, their mantra is energy dominance, and what we've seen thus far on onshore oil and gas development is the same kind of pattern, you know, putting up as much as they possibly can, eschewing environmental restrictions. One of the key features of onshore oil and gas leasing was that the BLM had the ability to defer leases if they were near sensitive sites or ecologically important areas. And what we're already seeing is that those kinds of deferrals are being eliminated completely or used much, much less frequently. So the offshore drilling announcement, I think it's shocking in many ways, but it really is part of this administration's attempt to wring every last drop of oil and gas from the United States.
Well, you used an interesting term, energy dominance. What's the difference, do you think, between the talk of energy independence that started in the Carter administration and Trump's current discussion, his current use of the term energy dominance?
Well, I think the fact is that the United States is far less dependent on foreign oil. You know, we're producing historic amounts of oil and gas, competing with Saudi Arabia and Russia. And, you know, I think Trump from very early on, when he was campaigning, had this kind of nostalgic vision of a country that led because of its production of energy. And, you know, he's made a big deal about saving the coal industry. And I think it's very much a political calculation, but it's also very real in terms of the policies that are being enacted.
Well, what do you think of the differences? I mean, because the way you describe it in your articles, it just feels like every single inch of public land is up for grabs from the oil and gas and coal industries. Is that really the case? I mean, are we about to see the largest exploitation of public lands for energy production that this country's ever seen?
Well, it's quite possible. I mean, Department of Interior announced that they're having the largest offshore oil and gas lease sale in the country's history in the Gulf of Mexico in March or April. I think the big question is whether these leases will actually be bought. I mean, that's the we don't know. I mean, the market right now is not supporting, you know, huge development of unexplored area, and offshore oil and gas production is costly and risky. So I think that the administration will tout the fact that it's offering up, you know, more acreage than ever, but whether that translates into a huge increase in production or development remains to be seen.
Well, actually, you mentioned in your articles that a lot of these companies have lots and lots of oil leases that they're not even using. So why would they want to buy any more?
Right. It's well documented that the industry is sitting on leases that have been approved, and they could start developing them tomorrow if they wanted to. But the price simply isn't high enough to justify increasing production at this point. But there's a lot of speculation about, you know, why they might be interested in picking up additional leases. You know, with oil prices relatively low, many of these leases are going for rock bottom prices, you know, $2 an acre. So in terms of, you can stockpile leases and then when prices go up, turn around and sell them. So there's a certain amount of speculation perhaps involved. But in some of the lease sales, for example, in Nevada, they've offered huge amounts of land, hundreds of thousands of acres of land, and only a small fraction of it has actually been bought up by the industry at this point.
Well, I know that with Shell Oil, who was infamous a few years ago for the fiasco trying to drill in the Chukchi Sea off the coast of Alaska, that their stock price was dependent on the number of leases they have, and I can't remember the term right now, for when they have a certain amount of oil that they think they might be able to extract from the earth, and that determines the value of the company. And it turned out that they were way overvalued. So I'm thinking that there's all these different examples of how all the latest pushes to do extreme extraction of oil and gas, particularly oil, are really falling flat. And I wonder, does that reality check at all enter into the equation of just how effective the push to develop public lands is going to be?
Yeah, I think it does factor in. And I think that what we're going to see is investment in areas that have proven oil and gas reserves and where industry already has infrastructure. For example, the Permian Basin in Texas, there's a good chunk of it also in New Mexico that is largely on public land, and most of those leases have been purchased. So I think we'll see a good deal of development there in the coming years. And of course, you know, Alaska is in the crosshairs with the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge now being opened up to oil and gas development, and a number of other the National Petroleum Reserve, which is nearby. So I think this, certainly in the coming months, we will get a better sense of sort of where industry is going to focus its efforts.
Well, it seems that there's been a lot of talk about how all of Trump's efforts to prop up the coal industry are really not helping. Coal is not going to come back. And I keep thinking about the Shell fiasco. I mean, they lost, I don't know how many billions of dollars trying to, I mean, they went up to Alaska to drill after having huge problems down here in Portland and in Seattle getting their ships out of the port, and having this one ship that carried all the vital equipment they needed in case they had a blowout like the BP oil spill. And that ship got stuck in Portland after it had developed a gash by trying to take a shortcut. There's all these protests here and in Seattle, and then they kind of lost their window of opportunity. They only had a few weeks where they could actually set up the drilling in Alaska. They discovered nothing, and they left. And at that point, they pulled out of that lease. So yep. I just wonder if that's not a lesson that other oil companies are looking at and going, do we really want to go drill up in Alaska?
Yeah, I don't know that those are the kinds of lessons that the oil and gas industry pays much attention to. I mean, I you mentioned the BP blowout. I think one of the other interesting and troubling things to be aware of is the fact that the regulations governing offshore oil and gas development that were put in place after the BP blowout are currently being rewritten, and many argue weakened substantially. And we're seeing this across the board at Department of Interior, an effort to reduce regulations that they believe are a burden to energy development. So that you know, one, that makes it financially easier for these companies to take on these risky projects, and of course it also increases the chance that there will be some kind of environmental disaster like the ones that we've seen in the past.
And actually, the Fenica, the boat that was boat is a small word for that device that was in our harbor for a while. I mean, that wouldn't have even been required, I guess, under the new rules. Is that true? Because, I mean, it had I forget the terms for what they had, but basically all the protections in case they had a blowout, and that was required by law after the BP blowout for any drilling, any offshore deep-sea drilling.
Yes. I mean, that is still the well control rule that was written during the Obama administration. Parts of it have been implemented, parts of it have not, and to my understanding that the administration is currently revising that rule and will issue its findings relatively soon. So we don't quite know yet exactly what kinds of changes they'll make to it, but you know, their motivation is to make things easier and to make it less expensive for these companies to drill offshore.
Well, just to spook our listeners, let's talk about some of the regulations that are being overturned or loosened.
Yeah, where to start? I mean, the list is so long. You know, you mentioned the coal mining on federal land. There was a moratorium on new mines on federal land that has been lifted, and part of the reason, the primary reason for that moratorium was to conduct a review of the federal coal leasing program, which is deeply flawed, and that review has been discarded. You know, the rules that have been repealed range from, you know, the BLM had a new fracking rule that they were had spent 5 or 6 years writing, and it was, you know, it was a rule that updated the department's ability to regulate fracking, which of course in the last decade and a half has changed dramatically, and then the department simply wasn't equipped to address those changes. So that rule has been repealed. You know, there are rules dealing with royalties on coal, federal coal. And in October, the department issued a paper outlining what they consider to be burdens on energy development. And those rules and regulations, it is my understanding, are now being, you know, either reversed or modified in some way.
Well, one of the ones that struck me was removing the controls on flaring methane from oil, I guess, and also gas operations. And that's one of the most lethal greenhouse gases. And it seems like that's something that the Trump administration does not care about at all, whereas the Obama administration towards the end was at least starting to appreciate that there were so many greenhouse gas emissions from the production of oil and gas through this kind of needless flaring that it had to be controlled. So what does that say to you about the fact that we are going to allow flaring to continue? Or maybe we should even talk about what flaring is.
Yeah, I mean, not only is it, you know, harmful to climate and air quality, but it's just a huge waste of this product. And I think industry has, you know, it's in their best interest ultimately to not have to vent and flare and to invest in the gathering lines that allow them to get this stuff to wherever it needs to go. But I, you know, this administration philosophy has been to reverse and undo everything that had been put in place during the Obama years. So the methane venting and flaring rule has run into some roadblocks. They tried to repeal it through the Congressional Review Act, but they didn't have enough senators to achieve that. So now it's kind of tied up in the rulemaking process, which is quite laborious and drawn out, and is also certainly going to face legal challenges. So it's unclear whether that they'll ultimately prevail in repealing that rule.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Adam Fetterman, who's a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute this morning. We're talking about the gutting of the Department of Interior as an agency that most of us would expect it to be. And you're listening here on Locus Focus on Cable Community Radio in Portland and on KBFG LPFM in Seattle. One of the things that I thought a lot about as I was reading your article was how this compares to other periods of time in the not that distant future, within my adult lifehood, where we've had the Department of Interior kind of turned on its head by very conservative and very pro-energy industry administrations. And I started thinking, well, is this any worse than what we've been through before? And there's this key person that you wrote an article about in The Nation a couple months ago, this guy, James Kaysen, who nobody knows his name. I certainly didn't remember him from the other administrations he worked for. However, I remember the people he worked with and the impact. So I wanted to talk a little bit about who this guy is, the role that he's playing now in the Trump administration's Department of Interior. And is what he's doing now any worse than what he did under the Reagan administration and the George W. Bush administrations?
Yeah. There are certainly a lot of parallels, and one of the reasons why I wanted to profile Kaysen is precisely because of his connection to the Reagan administration. He served under James Watt, Reagan's Interior Secretary, in the early 80s, and then he came back during the George W. Bush administration and served under Gail Norton. His position is Associate Deputy Secretary, which is basically third in command at the department, but it's a position that does not require Senate confirmation, so very few people have heard of Kaysen. He's been there. He was there during the transition. He has served essentially in the top spot for the first 6 or 7 months until David Bernhardt was confirmed as deputy secretary. And, you know, he has a long track record of serving industry and gutting environmental rules and regulations. He's quite effective. He knows the department inside out, and he's surrounded by a team of political appointees who also served under George W. Bush. And I think one of the sort of narratives of the first year of the Trump administration has been the relative dysfunction of many of these federal agencies. But I think Department of Interior has, in fact, been quite efficient and effective in moving this agenda along, in large part because of people like Kaysen who have been there before and know exactly what they're doing.
Well, I found it interesting you mentioned that in your article that this position that he has now was actually a position created for him in the George W. Bush administration. And why was that position created for him especially?
Right. Yeah, it's an interesting wrinkle. So Kaysen, in 1989, was actually appointed to serve in a top environmental post at the Department of Agriculture under George H.W. Bush. And that position did require Senate confirmation. And during those hearings, Kaysen's record at Department of the Interior during the 1980s was fully exposed, and the committee hearings are quite revealing and extensive. And ultimately, Kaysen had to withdraw his name because his record was so controversial, and that was unusual for that position. I mean, it was a position at the Department of Agriculture. It was not a particularly high-profile post, and the fact that he was considered too controversial for it, I think, says a lot. And much of the hearings revolved around his ties to James Watt and his philosophy toward public lands and many of the decisions that he had made during the 1980s. So according to the people I spoke to for that story, when he came back under George W. Bush, they decided to create this position that would, that does not require Senate confirmation to avoid any kind of, controversial hearing that might have led to him having to withdraw his name again.
What was the difference between his position under George W. Bush and his position under Ronald Reagan?
Well, under Reagan, when he joined the department, he was at the BLM in a sort of a mid-level position, and then he was in the division that deals with minerals and mining from 1985 to 1989. And he served under a gentleman named Stephen Griles, who would also come back under George W. Bush and ended up being indicted for his ties to the disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff. So Kaysen was a close friend of Griles and learned a lot from him, in fact, about, changing environmental rules and regulations.
Well, it seems like, Jack Abramoff, you just start thinking about tons and tons of money and ripping off Native American tribes. But it seemed like what Kaysen learned from Stephen Griles was more than just changing regulations. There's an awful lot to do with money, and it seems like saving a lot of money for the industry and, in effect, a lot of losing a lot of money for the government.
Yes, absolutely. Under Griles, they moved to, reduce royalty rates on coal. Those things really do matter. And one of the first rules, in fact, that the Trump administration reversed was a new royalty reform rule that would have eliminated a loophole that allows coal companies to essentially calculate royalties on coal that are, well below market value. So I think we're seeing some of the same kinds of patterns, already that Kaysen engineered under, both Reagan and George W. Bush. And yes, absolutely, it plays right into the pocketbooks of the energy industry.
So how does what Kaysen's doing now compare to, let's say, the damage that he's doing now compared to the damage that he did, particularly under the George W. Bush administration?
Right. Yeah, I think it's useful to remember just how aggressive the George W. Bush administration was in terms of its energy policy. Early on, they had this energy task force. I think Griles was in fact part of that task force. That they held these meetings in secret with Dick Cheney to kind of craft energy policy. And then they had a similar philosophy toward development in terms of opening up public lands and offshore oil and gas development as well. But it seems to me that at that time there were perhaps a few more checks on what the department could do. I really get the sense now that, and I think the resignations at the National Park System Advisory Board are indicative of this. They're just shutting out any dissenting voices, and it's as if there are no restrictions at all. And they don't seem to even care about the appearance of a conflict of interest. So even that's not stopping them.
Because I've been thinking a lot about comparing the George W. Bush administration with the current administration. Because I'm reading this book by Jane Mayer. It was written in 2008 about, it's called The Dark Side. And it's basically about the torture that the United States not only condoned but encouraged in the war on terror, in quotes. And as I was reading that, I was thinking, you know, it's not like Donald Trump isn't that much worse than George W. Bush. In fact, George W. Bush seemed to be a lot, in terms of terror, you know, in terms of torture and things like that, was far more effective in creating these policies and these practices that had no oversight except for a very small enclave, like a cabal of people. And all these people that were trying to blow the whistle on it were just shut out over and over again. So I guess I'm really wondering if this is any worse, the situation we're in. I mean, to me, the only difference is that there were some Republicans in those days that had some ethics who would stand up to what Bush was doing. And it seems like now there's very, very little pushback on the part of Republicans against the worst excesses of the Trump administration. I'm wondering how you see the comparison, and are things actually even worse now than they were under Bush?
It may be too soon to tell. You know, Bush, I guess, had the advantage of getting reelected, and we don't know yet if Trump will be so lucky. I think if he is reelected, my gut tells me that his administration will be significantly worse. You know, Bush was unsuccessful in opening up offshore drilling in many of the areas that the Trump administration has its eyes on. So I think that the impact of that would be profound. But in terms of the sort of overall philosophy, I think there are certainly many parallels, and you know, the Bush-Cheney years were you know, hugely destructive.
I guess because I'm thinking in terms of gleaning some lessons, because people did, I mean, people, when they started tracking what was going on during the Bush-Cheney years, they, in the Gail Norton years, they had some very effective ways of pushing back. And so there was I think the BPO explosion was a great example of the what was going wrong with the Department of Interior in those years.
Yeah.
So there's some real huge consequences of it, but that there, it did set the motion for some real changes in thinking and eventually some changes in policy. So I just wonder if we can't glean from those lessons and maybe being prepared to take on the Trump administration in other ways than just resigning from the commissions and the advisory boards.
Yes. Well, and I think that the certainly conservation groups, environmental organizations are very much forward-looking in that regard. I mean, and just about every decision that the Department of the Interior has made, every rule that it has tried to reverse or repeal has been challenged, and many of those are you know, will be playing out in the courts for some time. And I think that, you know, lessons have been learned. I think the unfortunate thing is that some of the positive changes that took place as a result of the scandals of the George W. Bush years, and there really were some major scandals at the Department of the Interior, some of those changes are now being reversed. And, you know, one of the big ones, in fact, after the BP blowout was to split up the agency that oversaw offshore drilling and also collected royalties to break it up into two different agencies to avoid any kind of conflict of interest. And, you know, those two agencies still exist, but there has been talk about, you know, recombining them in some fashion. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that I think would really turn back the clock.
Well, what I get the impression from your articles is that the big thing is that there's this major shift in thinking of the Department of Interior. We used to think about it primarily as like our national parks. I mean, that was kind of its iconic value. And of course, it also is responsible for all kinds of energy development on public lands. But we're seeing this shift away from there being any thought that there's that the Department of Interior would have anything to do with conservation, with protecting endangered species, and all the things that we and protecting our national parks for that matter. So I wonder how strong is this movement to just grab the national lands for the express benefit of the energy industry, and how much is that? Is it possible that if that's pushed too far, that there'll be a lot of blowback from that?
Well, I think we're already seeing the blowback. You know, there were substantial rallies in Utah when they announced that they were going to be reducing Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante. But that's certainly not going to stop them. I mean, this administration doesn't really seem to pay heed to opposition. So I think we're going to see continued efforts to reduce national monuments, and also to open oil and gas development in areas that had been highly restricted. You know, one of those I wrote about was Dinosaur National Monument. There was a lease sale there. This is in northeastern Utah, a lease sale in December with several parcels that were, you know, within eyesight of the national monument. And during the previous 8 years, there had been an effort to develop a long-term leasing strategy that would, you know, it would allow both for development and also preservation of places like Dinosaur that have, you know, cultural and ecological value. And those kinds of long-term planning efforts have been completely dismantled. And the sort of default position now is to just offer everything that the BLM is able to offer.
Well, actually, in that article, you wrote something that really distressed me. You're describing the community of Vernal and how exploited it's been. And I went through Vernal, I think, Vernal, Utah, in 1999, and it was pretty pristine in those days. And I was talking to some people from the tribe there who were describing how they were really trying to oppose shale drilling for oil shale. And it was not even a done deal. And then, of course, the rest of the Bush administration proceeded in the next 8 years. So let's talk about what happened to Vernal and how that's like a hard lesson for the rest of that region.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that's an excellent example, case study of what happened during the Bush years and the Obama years, quite frankly, in a rural community that experienced just a massive surge in oil and gas development that has led to really severe air quality issues. I mean, Vernal is a city of about 10,000. There's very little heavy industry other than oil and gas development. And in the last decade, they've had ozone readings that exceed those of major cities like Los Angeles and Houston. And because of the topography, it's a basin that's sort of surrounded by mesas and mountains. The pollution tends to get trapped in the lower levels during the winter time when they have these temperature inversions. So it creates this really toxic environment. And there's some speculation that it's led to an increase in infant mortality, asthma rates, and a whole host of other public health issues that, quite frankly, haven't even been fully analyzed or even understood out there. So the fact that they're now considering greatly expanding the development in that region without even taking into account the you know, the potential impact on air quality is truly disturbing. And one other footnote to that story is that the EPA has dragged its feet in issuing its designations of areas that are considered non-attainment zones if they don't meet the federal criteria for ozone. You know, that's not a surprise under the current leadership of the EPA, but it's leaving a lot of people wondering whether they're going to issue that designation. And if they don't, it means that industry can continue to operate without meeting certain, you know, certain thresholds that are designed to reduce pollution and try to solve the ozone issue out there.
Well, this morning we're talking with Adam Fetterman, who is a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, and we're talking about how the Trump administration gives big oil the keys to the public lands, which is the title of one of his articles in the Nation the last few months. And you're listening to us here on Locus Focus on Kibu Community Radio in Portland. and on KBFG LPFM in Seattle. Well, a friend of mine who actually is on this show quite frequently, Dominic Della Sala, who's a forest ecologist down in Ashland, and he sent me this article about Ryan Zinke, who I want to spend the rest of this hour talking about Zinke specifically and his qualifications or lack of to be the Department of Interior's head. So this article says, Interior Department Secretary Ryan Zinke took his professed love for hunting to the world's largest gun trade show in Las Vegas this week, where he spread the word on the importance of public land access. Speaking on the Josh Trolley radio show from the event Thursday morning, Zinke said he attended the Shooting Hunting Outdoor Trade Show, which he referred to as Trump Country, to let people know that our public lands belong to our people and not the government. Local voices have been ignored, Zinke told the radio host, adding that the administration is opening our roads and letting people enjoy their land and putting the R back in recreation, appearing to allude to Republican. These special interest groups don't want people on what they perceive as their land. You cannot even ride a mountain bike or a lot of land on a lot of lands, so we need to adjust that. Zinke made a number of radio appearances at the event and tweeted out photos of him doing interviews with conservative radio hosts Michael Coolidge and Dana Loesch. And in his time as Interior Secretary, Zinke's made strong policy pushes to expand hunting opportunities on national parkland and has made no secret of his passion for hunting. On his first day in office last year, Zinke issued an order which overturned a recent ban on lead ammunition and fish tackle on the Fish and Wildlife Service lands and waters. In September, he issued another secretarial order designed to increase access to public lands for hunters and fishes. And then it goes on about how he's advocated shrinking the Grand Staircase, Escalante, and Bears Ears National Monuments. So what does that say to you about this guy who's now the head of the Department of Interior? That he's got a great love for hunting and a great love for hunters. And I think the most chilling thing was about his belief that the government should be taken off public lands, they should be given back to the people, whatever that means.
Yeah, well, it's very clear who he's directing those comments to and who his audience is, of course, out in Nevada, home to the Bundys. I mean, I think a lot is going on there. And one of the interesting things about Zinke is that he made a big deal about opposing the federal transfer of land to states when he was a member of the Republican National Committee when it was drafting its platform for the convention. He actually resigned over the fact that they were pushing for greater, you know, state control. But, you know, what we're seeing, in fact, is that very agenda being pushed forward. And it's I think it's being done in relatively clever ways that in some ways have avoided scrutiny. I mean, the monuments thing was a big deal and obviously got a lot of attention. But in terms of opening more and more access to wilderness areas and refuges for hunting and fishing, and just in general catering to the hunting community as sort of the most important faction of the conservation minded outdoor world is extremely limited. But you know, Zinke has his eyes on higher office, and I think much of what he's doing is designed to kind of bolster his political career, and he's kind of playing all the pushing all the right buttons to do that.
Well, I wonder about the semi scandal about his travel expenses. Do you think that that's going to have any effect on him?
I think it's unlikely. You know, he's had issues in the past with ethical violations when he was a Navy SEAL in terms of travel. He certainly seems to take liberties with that sort of thing. There are a number of ongoing investigations, and who knows what they might reveal. But it, at least, you know, thus far, doesn't seem to have harmed him to any, you know, to any great degree.
Well,
yeah.
Well, one last thing I want to talk about is all the oil drilling that's being proposed, because there's so much pushback. And even Lisa Murkowski, the senator from Alaska, who signed on to the tax bill in exchange for promises of opening up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to drilling, she's not happy with all the places that are being proposed for drilling. So do you see that the pushback from her, and of course Rick Scott got his way, and supposedly the drilling leases were pulled from the coast of Florida, though even that's being debated. Meanwhile, our governor, Kate Brown, is going on national talk shows talking about what a horrible idea it is to drill off the beautiful coast of Oregon, which is one of the most gorgeous coasts in the United States. I say impartially. But do you think that pushback is going to have any effect?
I think it already has. And I think that it's also revealed how poorly considered this offshore leasing plan was. The whole point of having these kinds of advisory boards like the National Park System Board is to, I think, probably avoid that kind of thing. But, you know, Zinke and his small team of political appointees are not listening to anyone else. I think there's a great deal of opposition, as you just sort of outlined, and I think Zinke's willingness to sort of cater to Rick Scott in Florida and to reverse his position literally the day after the plan had been announced is really going to come back to haunt him and the department, because I think from a legal point of view, that's really going to undermine their effort to open up other coastal areas. So it was a very Trumpian move in the fact that he put his foot in his mouth, and I think has probably done more damage to his own argument than anyone else could have.
Well, while we've been talking, I just got an email with some very exciting news, and I want to throw this out to you as an alternative to the Trump reality. I don't know how much you're following the oil and gas and coal projects that have been foisted on the Northwest, and all have been pretty successfully fought back. And I just heard that Washington Governor Jay Inslee just rejected the largest oil shipping terminal proposed in North America as not in the best interests of the state and its people. The Tesoro Savage Project, also known as Vancouver Energy, sought to ship over 131 million barrels of oil per year down the Columbia River. Governor Inslee cited the comprehensive review and recommendation of the Energy Facilities Site Evaluation Council, which found unavoidable catastrophic risks from earthquake oil spills in the Columbia River and the Pacific Ocean, and the threat of fire or explosion at the facility. So this project is now dead, as are about another almost 20 other projects that have been proposed. We're still fighting frack gas proposals in here in Oregon and Washington. But this shows to me that there's some power still on the regional level, and that we can fight back against the oil industry. So I wonder, hearing this news, what that makes you think.
Yeah, well, and we've seen that in other places, too. I used to live in New York, and groups in New York have had a good deal of success in fighting both fracking and development of new pipelines. And I do think that that's where the battle lines will be drawn, you know, is at the state level. And even though the department has a great deal of authority to kind of open up land to oil and gas development, there are still a lot of hoops to jump through. And I mean, by all means, there's a great deal that could be done, you know, on the ground to fight back, and if not, just push these things into the courts where they can get tied up for years, if not decades, or to, you know, in the case of this recent example, you know, actually stop these kinds of projects from moving forward.
Well, actually, Bill McKibben's been writing article after article in The Nation about the importance of local efforts and the power of local communities. And is that our frontier for the next couple of years until maybe things shift politically again and on the federal level?
I think yes, and I think it always, you know, in a sense, has been. Perhaps it's easy for I think people maybe become somewhat more complacent when they feel like their leadership is perhaps looking out for their best interests. But I think the fight for to push toward renewable energy and to resist, whether it's a coal shipping facility or oil and gas pipelines, that has come from the local level, whether it's the Keystone Pipeline or, fracking in New York State. So I think that's only going to continue and probably grow in the next several years.
So in the next few months, what are you planning on reporting on? Are you going to continue keeping a strong eye on the Department of Interior?
Yes, I'll be looking at Department of Interior. In fact, a number of the issues that we've discussed today are high on my list of things to pursue, including offshore development and changes to the well control rule and some of the issues surrounding the transfer of state of land and authority to state agencies, which I think has been overlooked.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us, Adam.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
We've been talking with Adam Fetterman, who's a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. And if this program today was hard enough to swallow, next week we're going to be talking about something a little closer to home. We'll be talking with Tom Carpenter and Liz Matson, who are with Hanford Challenge, and Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper, about the latest leaks and near disasters at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, 200 miles upstream from us here on the Columbia River. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by John Prine, Paradise. Thanks for listening.
When I was a child, my family would travel down to western Kentucky, where my parents were born. And there's a backwards old town that's often remembered so many times that my memories are worn. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away. Well, sometimes we travel right down the Green River to the abandoned old prison down by Avery Hill, where the air smelled like snakes and we'd shoot with our pistols, but empty pop bottles was all we would kill. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by...